is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey, cousin, you are listening to the Screen Watching Podcast. My name is Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Each week we get onto this here podcast. We talk about the movies. We talk about the TV shows. We talk about inane anecdotes of years gone by that no one really cares about. And sometimes, yes, folks, sometimes we talk about the weather. This week on the podcast, we've got some big titles. Big-ish. There's a strike on.
There's not that much pipeline to talk about.
It's not what it was. And actually, let's talk about pipeline stuff in a short while, Simon. We'll get back to that. But what we will talk about on a podcast today are the following things. Simon, he's got some movies to talk about. He's going to talk about Talk to Me. I have no idea what that is. He's going to talk about the movie Sisu. I know exactly what that is. And folks, you are in for a motherfucking great time with that one. Sorry, I just got an explicit tag, didn't I? Folks, I'm going to talk about Special Ops Lioness, which is the brand new show from Taylor Sheridan. And I got some thoughts. I'm also going to do, and I'll curb the swearing here, but it's certainly in my notes, Dan's gosh darn huge grab bag of quick bites. I'm going to talk about the new Minx TV series, well, the returning season of, which we talked about last year, so I don't want to deep dive into it. Futurama, which everybody's seen before, and I'm going to give like a top level thought about the new season that's debuted after a return of like 7 or 8 years or something crazy. Also, I'm going to talk very briefly about a documentary you can't watch here in Australia. It's called Glitch, The Rise and Fall of HQ Trivia. I've got some Oppenheimer thoughts. I've got some Shin Kamen Rider thoughts. I've got some very strong thoughts about... we'll get to that in a bit. Folks, this is Screen Watching. Simon, I just remember we do the opening titles at the beginning now and we don't go into that. So I've structured this poorly and let's go into a casual conversation. Simon, how are you?
130 episodes of the Screen Watching Podcast, and we're still trying to figure out how to do the opening. Hello, everyone. Good to talk to you. Good to talk to yeah. And on top of all of that, I'll be looking at a little doco series called Superpowered. I thought you'd be all over this. This is the DC comic story, and I've discovered a cute thing on Netflix called Feel Good, which I'll be chatting about later on in the show. It is, I mean, for a show that it's struggling to find things to watch on screens. We've done a lot of screen watching.
So I do this daily newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. Subscribe to
fine publication. Yep. Absolutely.
It's pretty good. So I do this thing and I was looking at the oncoming strike and I was looking at release schedules and shows being bumped backwards, movies being bumped backwards in the schedules as well. Yes. Tennis threesome movie with Zendaya that I can't remember the name of.
Challenges. Yep.
Challenges. That looked really good. I was super into seeing that. Delayed till next year sometime now. Frustrating. The other Zendaya film, Dune, strongly rumored we're going to see that punted back.
It'll be moved.
As well.
It'll absolutely be moved. And here on local soil, it's impacted the local industry with the new Eric Banner film, The Dry 2, pulling all of its August 24 release dates because Eric can't do in-person appearances and Q&As and that sort of thing because he's a member of SAG-AFTRA. So it's impacted the local industry in that regard as well.
And also, come on. It's either dry or it's not dry. You can't have the dry too. Like, come on.
The drier.
The driest. Yeah. So I was looking at this oncoming strike action. I thought, I put out this daily newsletter. I don't think I'm going to be doing a daily newsletter for much longer. But since I was having those, like, deep existential thoughts, I've had more to write about than maybe ever. It's been a busy time.
Well, yes. I mean, it may take your newsletter off into a whole lot of different directions with the industry sort of going through this kind of impact and this kind of change in the months ahead.
Well, that's kind of it because
it's
not just strike change, but like there's just other like the strikes are symptomatic of other changes happening within the industry, and it feels as though with the strike because you can only talk about the strikes so many days in a row without just being the same story. Okay, like nothing's really changing in that space outside of, they haven't come to the table again today, and that's kind of it. But there's all these other aspects which are kind of all like congealing at the same time, which is super exciting.
Well, I'm sure you'll cover it with much elan in your newsletter. And I've just had a thought. I did read in your newsletter this week, as I stare behind me at my beautiful wall of about 1/8 of the DVDs that I own, that wall behind me is actually too thick, so it's quite a huge compilation. And then there's all the ones down in my storage unit. But Disney are pulling all their physical media with the release of Guardians of the Galaxy 3. That'll be the last, I guess, all the physical media, whether it's the 4K or the Blu-ray or the DVD, is no more. Does that include their catalog titles?
Well, see, this is the thing, and that's what I was about to just jump in on. The wording seems to be, like, the comment is that it's all the new titles, but presumably that doesn't stop them from releasing occasionally, like, special bonus editions of stuff. So, you know, I mean, it could well be a, you know, 9-disc Star Wars set coming out from them, or, you know, all the Dalmatians you can poke a stick out box or something.
Is that simply... Yes, DVD's on the decline, and although there's been a groundswell of support for physical media in the wake of not being able to find what you want when you want.
Groundswell is probably the word. Like, where I think it's going, Simon, and maybe I'm just sort of cutting you off on your thought here, is that at the moment you think about physical media, it's DVDs, it's Blu-rays, you go down to your JB Hi-Fi or your other, you know, stores that sell such things. Those sections are becoming a little bit smaller. They're kind of being pushed towards the back of the store. Like, it's not quite the mainstream thing that it once was. Video games, I've noticed, in physical discs seems to be moving forward. And I'm surprised that the physical discs are selling so well, because, you know, you can buy those digitally now and there's that aspect of things. But the movies are sort of pushing their way back, and it's just purely because people are just streaming stuff consistently. I think there'll always be a market for people who are after that physical material, but by and large I think it's going to become niche, and Disney will stop releasing everything on DVD and Blu-ray, but it probably won't stop them from licensing titles to smaller distributors who are doing things ad hoc and maybe not necessarily just those latest titles, but, you know, maybe pulling out like that retrospective idea of doing a disc about Condor Man or something from back in the day.
That's likely. Okay. All right, well, that's interesting. I'm keen to see if the other distributors follow suit. I'm keen to see if there's some huge push or huge catalog surge on the Disney Plus streaming platform that's going to make up for all these missing DVD titles. But it's an interesting state of affairs.
Sorry, just on that, Simon, I'd also just sort of say that it's not just physical media that's being impacted on this, but if you think about Disney as a company, have their tendrils and all sorts of pot plants around the place. Essentially what we've been saying is, as they launch Disney Plus into the market, they've been pulling some of those other tendrils back to give Disney Plus like the maximum push that it can have. So obviously physical media, that's going to be tied into declining sales across the board and just lack of consumer engagement around that product category. But when they did launch in Australia and in areas across Europe and the UK, you'll find that they end up pulling a lot of the Disney linear cable channels off the respective services. So as various deals expired, like the Disney Channel disappeared, Disney Junior and some of the other affiliated channels around the world, they just pull those off those services. So it really is Disney Plus first, and cinema, and then merchandise and other channels. But they're keeping things very as simple and contained as possible.
Apart from the weird tendrils in a pot plant analogy, that was a very concise and interesting way of putting things.
Yeah.
As we record this,
I'm just trying to cater towards that missing arborist demographic that we know is out there, but just aren't connecting with the podcast just yet.
Nailed it. Very sad day for us children of the 90s here. Or I guess I was in my 20s in the 90s. You're a child of the 90s. Sinead O'Connor passed away yesterday. I had all her albums, The Lion and the Cobra, and all the great albums that came after that. Was such a huge part of my music listening period, which I don't do as much anymore. And I think I might. We watched the Nothing Compares documentary on SBS On Demand last night, and it was a very moving portrait of a young lady who really stood against the system and bucked and railed as hard as she could against the injustices of the world, and society wasn't quite ready for that at the time, and she suffered badly. So RIP Sinead, you brought a lot of hope and guts and beautiful music to the world.
Yes. The probably one of the defining sort of cultural moments for me was the SNL ripping of the Pope image, and obviously a defining moment in her life and career as well. Why that was so, I guess, sort of epic in my life is it's the first time that I've really seen like a controversy around that, where someone was making a political stand and really putting their career out there, and then seeing the way that the media and culture just turned on her in like a really big way. And I don't think you'd get that anymore. I think that that would be met with a shrug of indifference or just a, oh, it's Sinead just being Sinead. I just don't think that you'd really see that outcry. But certainly back then, and particularly, obviously, the Pope held a very specific sort of role in culture. I think even the Pope these days, that's not generating that level of bite back.
Yeah, I think that to use the sort of viewing numbers that SNL had at that point in time and the cultural impact that had certainly had something to do with that. As the documentary points out, she was such a victim of the church, and her family through generations was such a victim of the church. That moment meant so many things to her, and she was quite taken aback by exactly how impactful this example of her free speech was taken to task and torn a shred by the very society that claims free speech is you know should be everyone's right. So it was and she didn't stop fighting for good causes and throughout her life. So RIP. She had a tough last few years. She lost her son to self-inflicted harm last year. I think we're still not sure how she passed away. It hasn't, as we record this, that hasn't been released yet. To my knowledge,
the gory details aren't there, but I think we know.
Yeah, I think there's a fair indication of that. So God bless you and all the best, Sinead.
Indeed. Simon, we do movie reviews and TV reviews, obviously. How about we dive into that? Do you want to tell us a little bit about a movie? It's called Talk to Me.
You busy tonight? You want to turn, eh?
My mum leaves at 9.
So you're at 10.
Yes!
So where'd you get it from anyway?
Apparently it was the hand of someone who could connect with the dead.
I heard it was the hand of a Satanist. The other hand's just out there.
Talk to Me is the latest super hot Aussie horror film. It's directed by two guys who are known as Raka Raka. That's their YouTube name, their podcasting name. It's actually two brothers, Danny and Michael Philippou, and they've created this extraordinarily cinematic sort of horror film, the likes of which you don't expect from a couple of YouTube brothers out of Adelaide to conjure. But I haven't seen Raka Raka's work online, but by all accounts, it's very well made sort of horror shorts, and they've taken all that skill and put it in the service of a very cool teen horror movie. It tells the story of a young woman played by, and I do want to get her name right, played by Sophie Wilde, with the young actress, who finds herself at a party where everyone is sort of daring each other to grab this mystical hand that's on the table. Now, it's kind of a silly construct. It's it's literally a human hand shape that you're meant to grab. And as you grab it, you say a few magical words and you're cast into a world of the possessed. You see beasts before you and you see all sorts of horrors. You trust your friends to pull you out of that after 60 seconds, but things start to get more and more dangerous and more lengthened in the time they decide to be possessed. And very soon, a Freddy Krueger-like menace is surrounding the kids of the suburb. It's very, very clearly all analogy and metaphor for drug taking and experimenting with things that are dangerous in your youth. What it does do is take those very obvious sort of symbols and turns it into this really terrific, very gory and quite scary little Aussie horror film that's been picked up by A24 in the States and is already coming off a bunch of sort of very strong festival showings, and it'll be in cinemas in the US very soon. Interesting that they've released it this week with so many people in cinemas watching Barbie and Oppenheimer and the rest. Hopefully it'll get a bit of flow on for that, and word of mouth on this film will be really, really strong. It's a very scary, very beautifully made little horror film.
Yeah. Something that just kind of caught my interest is I've got the two creators. Was it Danny and Michael Philippou?
Philippou, yep.
Philippou. Yeah, the two of them coming from Adelaide. It just strikes me that one, it's not unusual that we have horror directing brothers in Australia. You've also got the Spierig brothers who came out of Queensland about a decade and a bit ago.
And the two Cairns brothers who have Late Night with the Devil coming into cinema soon, Colin and I want to say Christopher maybe. They're terrific. But go on.
Where do they hail from?
I think they're Brisbaneites.
Okay, well, this is what I was about to say, which is that it strikes me that you get like the sort of real odd creativity that really seems to spur up in the local industry every so often. It never comes out of Sydney, never comes out of Melbourne. It's always Brisbane. It's always South Australia. And I was thinking back to South Australia, and you've obviously got David Ashby and Dario Russo, who did the Danger 5 series a couple of years back as well. So it's just kind of, I just kind of feel like that good sort of creativity centers, because when there's not a whole lot of other things to do, you get weird.
You get crazy, yeah, and there's no better place for that than Adelaide or Brisbane, two cities that I love dearly, but they kind of scare me.
We're perfectly pleasant up here, I promise.
Yeah, you just keep sucking on your weird drink there and keep telling us how pleasant you are.
Yeah, my weird beverage from the Coca-Cola company, a can of Mount Franklin. How weird. Crazy, man.
Let's get on to your Special Ops Lioness, which has had some very mixed reviews out of the States. I'm keen to hear what one Dan Barrett has to say about it.
I mean, you say mixed reviews, it seems like flat reviews would be the answer, but let's listen to a clip, talk about it on the other side.
I'm doing everything different this time.
Did your field agent do what you think's best?
I have to be sure.
If she's able to make contact with the target, what are her directives then?
Neutralize the target.
So this is a interesting-ish one, but I wouldn't say super interesting. It's not a must-watch, but it's kind of a, I'm very happy to add this to my weekly diet for the next like 8 weeks, and then, you know, we'll move on and maybe I'll see a second season. Who knows with Taylor Sheridan shows. So the premise of this one is, I'll read the little blurb and we'll get to what's interesting about it. Jo attempts to balance her personal and professional life as the tip of the CIA's spear in the war on terror. Basically, she works for the CIA. Let's forget about tips and spears. What a silly metaphor. She works for this thing called the Lioness Program, which enlists this woman named Cruz. I'm trying to think of her first name. We'll get to that. To operate undercover alongside Jo among the power brokers of state terrorism. Largely what this Lioness Program is that they figure that it's really hard to infiltrate a lot of overseas terrorist activities, like in terms of getting to the inner circle of these groups, but the way to do it is through the women. So, you know, they'll usually have a wife or multiple wives or multiple partners around the place. So this Lioness Program is about sending women out there. They befriend them, they get into that inner circle through their partnership, and then suddenly they're within like the, you know, bunkers of power. So what we've got here is the lead actor playing Jo is Zoe Saldana. I mean, I didn't really recognize her because she isn't covered in blue paint or green paint or whatever paint she's, you know, been sort of stripped into this time. And then you've also got Crew Manolis, and she's a bit of a street level badass. She used to be a stripper, but she decided that wasn't really a noble life. So she was working for a like hamburger chain, as we see her at the very beginning of the show, gets into a fight with her boyfriend who's abusing her in just all sorts of ways. He's got like some drug connections, and so he ends up you know, they have a bit of a showdown at the very beginning of the show. She smacks him across the face with I think it was an iron or something. It was something big and metal. I can't remember what it was, but anyway, she starts running through the suburbs. He chases after her. She ends up just running into a shop front, just trying to find somewhere to hide. He comes flying in straight afterwards, ready to like start wailing on her, and then suddenly gets stopped by the fact that it wasn't a regular shop she's gone into. It was a military enlisting place that, you know, they have in the US. You don't really get that in Australia. But yeah, so there's like some soldier and is saying, you know, this is what's going on now. And, you know, he puts the beat down, and then suddenly she joins the Marines and very quickly gets picked up by Zoe Saldana, who needs a replacement for an operative she just lost as part of the Lioness Project. When you see the billboards for this, you see the big names. You see Zoe Saldana. You see Nicole Kidman. You see Morgan Freeman. And I've seen the first two episodes, and two of those people are definitely in it. Okay? But Morgan Freeman, not mentioned in the opening titles. I haven't seen him in 2 hours of this program yet, so I don't know when we're going to see Morgan Freeman. Maybe episode three. I've got the screener sitting here. I haven't had the time to get to it, though.
Not be the first Hollywood project that very judiciously plans out their Morgan drop, though. Come on, that's...
Well, yeah, but whether it's the voice. Titles, it's just weird.
That seems odd.
Yeah. Nicole Kidman is definitely in it, okay? But if you chose to go to the bathroom at an inopportune time and you're only gone out of the room for about 30 seconds in each episode, you could well miss her.
First of all, if I'm going to the bathroom, it's not for 30 seconds. Second of all, I'm hanging around till I see one Nicole Kidman. I'm a fan. So that worries me that that only says to me that sort of signposts the fact that at some point later in the series, there's some major plot point's going to turn on her, or she's going to be not who she appears to be, or something like that.
Oh, look, maybe. But anyway, she plays like the sort of head of the specific part of the CIA that the Lioness Project sort of reports through.
Can I,
just a couple of things. So what's probably noteworthy about this is that Zoe Saldana's playing a character called Jo. And one of the criticisms that's been leveled at her is that the character of Jo, the character of Crew Manolis, like either of them could be men. Like it's sort of, it feels like the whole thing is written to be very gender neutral. The second episode, I do think, plays into the ideas of female abuse. And so I think that some of the critical complaints I've read out of the US, which is that it is so gender neutral, I don't think necessarily really apply to that character. But certainly the Zoe Saldana character could just as easily be a man. That's kind of interesting. But also, I don't know that's a negative. I think it's just kind of what it is. One of the more interesting aspects of the show, though, from what I've seen so far, is you've got the character of Jo and her husband, Neil. I don't know if they're legally married, but they're certainly long-term partners. But it's established from the very first episode that they've got very much an open relationship. Joe's sometimes away for months, if not longer at a time. Neil's a busy doctor. They've got a teenage daughter. But it does seem like they lead very separate lives, and they never really quite know when Joe's going to re-enter their life. And that just, to me, seemed like a very interesting way to approach it. And again, this maybe speaks to the fact it was written possibly as a man who really knows for sure, at least, you know, builds up this way. Because it just kind of, I don't remember the last time I saw a female lead in a story like this who doesn't feel like the weight of expectation and burden of, oh, I'm a woman, I'm a wife, I'm a mother, therefore I need to fill these roles. But boy, isn't it difficult balancing that with my professional life. This show is very much about a woman who is dedicated to that professional job and then like goes to find the creature comforts that she needs in life every so often by returning to her family. And that's a, I think, fairly unique sort of prospect for a TV drama or movie drama, really, for that matter.
2 points I want to make quickly. I'm watching something like this because I want to see international intrigue and espionage of a Jason Bourne type. So I'm hoping it plays out in that regard.
It's not quite that, but just keep in mind, this is from Taylor Sheridan, who, when we talk about Taylor Sheridan now, we're thinking Yellowstone, we're thinking cowboys, we're thinking the Old West in a sort of modern context. So you think about Yellowstone, but then you've got his prequel series, so you've got 1923 and 1883. So, you know, very much in that Western milieu. But then you think about some of his films, and so it was very much sort of Western capers, like there was Hell or High Water and Wind River. But the thing that you probably need to connect this to most is Sicario, the film that he wrote but did not direct. And that, I think, is probably a really important note here in that you're not expecting Jason Bourne-style US military activity. Really think about Sicario and the fact there's really a lot of meetings and a lot of planning and a lot of conversations going on. And then when there is a hot moment, when there's action taking place, it's short, it's sharp, and then it's really another couple of months of waiting for the next thing, which is fairly realistic in terms of that. But what I'd probably sort of warn is that if you're expecting to be Sicario, be a bit disappointed because it's Taylor Sheridan directing as well as writing. Okay, you don't have someone who's as craftful as Sicario director Denis Villeneuve, because if you remember the great thing about Sicario, like when you're watching that film, you've got like this great opening sequence where the tension's really building, it's really cinematic, and then there's the other iconic shot where they're going through the streets of whatever Mexico City they were in. It may well have been Mexico City, but you're going through the streets. And remember, there's that single camera shot where you're just following this parade of US military vehicles going through the city. You don't get that sort of thing here. It's very traditionally television shot. And I think to its detriment, because there is an opportunity to go bigger with this, and it doesn't quite do that, which is where I think that we're finding this disconnect between what critics are after and what the show is trying to do.
I don't know if you read the Variety review of this.
That was one penned by, what's her name?
Alison Herman.
Alison Herman, who I quite like.
She called it a shameless military propaganda show. Her first paragraph in the review, and I'm looking at it right now, just tears his completely nuance-free writing for women as the downfall of this, and that he is very much, Taylor Sheridan, I mean, is very much determined to maintain a patriarchal hierarchy in Hollywood through his works. And by turning this into a female-centered show, he's doing no one any favours.
Here's the thing. I read her review, and I just don't know that it's necessarily fair to what the show is and what they're trying to accomplish with it. I certainly don't think that they're really doing much to, you know, bolster the position of sort of female-driven storytelling. Sorry, it's got a little cough. Hang on.
A little cough.
I don't think you've got that. But ultimately, what you do have is a drama which, I mean, it could just well be men for the most part in this. But it's not.
But that's a missed opportunity, isn't it? Yeah, but isn't that a missed opportunity if you're just sort of implanting women into what could have been men roles? Isn't that lacking the nuance that she's talking about of not writing like specifically strong characters with women in mind?
Well, I mean, they are strong characters. It's just that I think they're a bit gender neutral. Like, I don't think they're necessarily leaning into like masculine stereotypes or female stereotypes. If anything, I mean, as I said, like the Crew Mignola's character, she, I think, does, like, she's there really sort of going through a lot of the victimhood of what it means to be a survivor of female sexual assault. Like, I think that's very well and truly established in that second episode. I don't know how much Alison Herman had to go off, and if she only got that first episode, and I suspect that critics all only got that first episode, I managed to get two, but I understand the US critics just got one. But that first episode, I think that what she has to say there is probably a justified sort of complaint. The second episode, I think, really tears away from what her criticisms of the show were. But also, I don't know why, because you've got a show that has female leads, suddenly it necessarily needs to be about what it means to be a woman in these situations. Why can they not fulfill the same role that men do, which is just they're in the situation and they're not necessarily informed by their gender. They're just kind of operating for the needs of the situation. Because this is not a strong... Outside of what you see in that second episode, I don't know there's a lot of strong thematic sort of underpinnings to a lot of this. It's really characters reacting and operating within bureaucratic systems. I don't know that one's gender necessarily has to play much of a role in what they're doing here. And to suggest that that needs to be the case, I think is actually being detrimental to like putting women
in stories. I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that, but only because for the last 100 years or the last 70 or 60 years of television, they're the only stories we've seen. If you're going to write a woman into a female lead, I think it does, it creates an opportunity for you to explore more within that genre and with that genre character than it would otherwise.
I'd say from like the last 20, 30 years, you start seeing a lot more female leads and particularly action-orientated dramas. In fact, I'd say it's probably more the standard to find a woman leading these sorts of things than a man these days. Especially in the last 5 to 10 years, but certainly going back, you started seeing a lot more. I mean, I probably come at this a bit more from fantasy sort of genre storytelling, but I mean, even in like the military sort of space, all the key examples I can think of are very much female-led. I'm thinking about your Zero Dark Thirties. I'm thinking about Sicario. I'm thinking about this. Like, it just kind of feels that this sort of genre has become very much sort of a female-led genre. But I don't necessarily know why you have to suddenly explore the idea of what it means to be a woman in this situation, because it means that all of this is going to have a very narrow framework of really what it's exploring. I mean, by and large, this sort of genre has a very narrow framework of what it's exploring. I just think it gets even more narrow if every time that you've got a female lead in this, you kind of have to look at it through the prism of what it means to be a woman. Like, it's like I just kind of think that you'd be a little bit broader than that.
There you go, Dan Barrett flying the flag for the patriarchy is once again.
I'm supporting women being able to do more than just talking about being women. I think that there's lots of interesting things out there, and asking for that, I think, just puts them in a very specific box, which I think is unfortunate.
It's called Lioness Down at the Shops. What's it called? Shops?
It's called Ops. Special Ops Lioness. Terrible name. Okay. Why not just call it Lioness? But clearly they've called it Special Ops Lioness so that... I'm sure this is a legal thing, so that, you know, when Zoe Saldana decides that she doesn't want to come back, or that in typical Taylor Sheridan fashion, in like one or two seasons, he just kills everyone and is like, oh, that was planned from the beginning. Sorry, we're just doing something new next time. Then Paramount can say, oh, well, you know, here's the other Special Ops series, Special Ops, you know, little cub. There we go. Branded right there.
All right. Let's head to Scandinavia where the patriarchy still rules. You go there, brothers, and have a look at a film called Sisu.
He was a Finnish commander. He lost his home and his family in the war. He became a one-man death squad.
Sisu, Simon, is this review going to be anywhere near as violent as this movie?
You know what? I'm a little bit surprised at my reaction to this because I was very hyped up to see this movie. It tells the story of a former Norwegian, I guess you could call him like a special ops person in the theme of the show, and someone who has the legend of being an unkillable military force. He's retired. On him digging
In World War II.
In World War II, yes. Yep. Yeah, this is all set in 1944, so towards the end of World War II. So we open the film with him digging in the dirt, looking for a stream of gold, which he ultimately finds and then sets off across country to cash in that gold and go off and live a quiet life somewhere. But he finds himself crossing paths with retreating German soldiers who are themselves bitter and want to finish off the war that they feel they're losing by wiping out this elderly Norwegian man, taking his gold and setting themselves up somewhere after the war. What they don't realize that Sisu is in fact Rambo, and he decides to do whatever he has to do to get his gold back and keep his dream alive of retiring somewhere off in the tundra. And what ensues is a very bloody, comically so, very gruesome take on the Rambo narrative. I thought it had trouble tonally. One minute it's comical, next minute it's quite seriously bloody. I found the German officers to be cartoonish in the extreme, but also to be that weathered sort of soldier type that is synonymous with these end of the war films. I did not enjoy it, and you'll see by my Letterboxd rating, I gave it 3.5 out of 5. So there's enough in there to have a good time. I just didn't think it was quite as inventive or quite as much fun as I had hoped it would be. Certainly, lots of raucous, bloody action to enjoy if you're in the mood for that sort of thing. So I know you saw it, Dan. You may have other thoughts.
No, it's probably not entirely different to what you said. So I would agree with all those criticisms. I think that tonally it is kind of all over the shop, and it doesn't really quite lean in enough of a direction to feel satisfying by the end of it. But that said, I think that if, first of all, the movie's only like 85, 90 minutes, so fantastic. I was very excited. Movie started at 6:30 for me. I was buying a burger by 8:15 on the way home. Like, it was brilliant. Had a great night out. It's a quick movie. It's not plotting like John Wick 3, which is what, 3 hours, which is more or less sort of treading the same thing. It's just creative violence. I would say that as fun and as bloody as a lot of the sequences were, like, it, to me, it didn't really seem as creative and over the top as I'd really expected it to be. I was thinking it'd be a little bit more, not necessarily wacky in the way that you expect it to be comedically sort of wacky, but just in terms of a, oh my God, I can't believe they did that kind of an approach to the action. And it never really has any moments like that.
It sort of went wacky in that the last few minutes underneath the plane, when I don't want to give anything away, but that's when I thought, okay, now you're getting into, you haven't earned the energy in your film to be this silly now and have us cheer along with it. It was at that point where I sort of rolled my eyes and went, all right, let's wrap it up.
To me, like, that isn't really necessarily earning it. If anything, it felt to me like the film just didn't really have the courage of its convictions to have a very dramatic standoff between the villain and the main lead. Instead, they went, oh, let's just go as over the top as possible. And so to me, that wasn't earned. If anything, it felt like a cheaper cop-out.
Yep.
But that said, I had a great time with it. I found it hugely like engaging. I was only checking my clock to see, oh my God, I can't believe there's only 15 minutes of this left. Like, it was, it moves along pretty quickly. I think there's some female characters in it who really get the short shrift. Some of the complaints about Lioness just then, I think, is very valid when talking about the movie Sisu. I thought the way they've treated the women in the thing just brutally horrible for no valuable reason, and moments to give them like a little hero moment towards the end, like that certainly did not feel earned. If anything, the film felt like it had been guilty of the same crimes that some of the Nazi soldiers get up to in the film.
Oh, geez. Okay, yeah.
It just treats them so badly. Like, they get treated like they're absolutely nothing. And it's, that's one of the huge disappointments of the movie. That said, ridiculously violent. It was pretty fun. I like that it was short. It's in, out. I had a good time.
Okay. So it's in cinemas essentially, this week.
The movie gives you exactly what you're after when you go in.
Oh, but yeah, Simon, sure.
Can I ask you this? So one of the things I'm really fascinated with, actually, sorry, we'll talk about this and I'll come back to why I found it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you realize the movie would be in English as much as it is?
No, I did not.
Because this is a Scandi film.
Yes, it is. In fact, when I started to watch it, I was watching their lips very carefully to see if I was watching a dubbed version.
That's the thing. Like, this is what I was thinking as well. And what I started thinking was there's technology at the moment sort of underway in not just Hollywood, but globally. Oh, yeah. You can see where I'm going with this because I talked about this.
We've talked about this before,
yeah. One of the things I'm really interested in is the rise of AI lip sync dubbing, where ultimately what you're doing is you're seeing this on a few fronts. Anyone who saw that movie, I'm going to say it was called Fall. It was that film with the two girls that climbed the TV antenna. You can find it on Netflix pretty easily. Yep. Depending on where you saw the film, you saw the language in the film is a bit different. And one of them, they're a bit swearier than the other version. And what they did with it, and you wouldn't notice it as the viewer, but they used AI so that instead, it's like the airline edits. Like, remember back in the day, you'd always find like an awkward sort of insert shot or some really bad dubbing over a line to get rid of the swears. They kind of did the same thing, but used AI like technology to change the mouth in terms of special effects. So it kind of looked like it was speaking naturally and then had that actual sort of double the line. Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, have they done that there? Not the case. It was just shot in English. But I spent film wondering if this was like a film where they actually really did spend a lot of money to try to get that international dubbing happening. Not the case. It is what we saw. But I would expect to see a lot more films that look and feel a bit like Sisu with a lot more English language over the coming years. And I don't know it was necessarily a bad experience. It was just an awkward experience because I was doing it for the first time thinking about the technology. But when that technology becomes a bit more widespread and we're just watching a lot of foreign language drama in English, like, you know, ultimately this kind of is proof of purchase.
And we've touched on this before. The only issue I have with that, and I have no problem with that technology being used. The only issue I have with that is that you miss the voice.
Yeah, but that's being taken care of as well. There's a lot of AI work to synthesize that actor's voice. So you're hearing the actor that you think you are on screen. Okay, it's just us speaking a different language. Well,
now you're talking about breathing control and now you're talking about diaphragm delivery. And if AI can do that, more power to it. But, yes. Okay, all right. That's interesting moving forward. But, I was a little bit taken by surprise when the German soldiers were kind of like, no, just let him pass. He'll be fine.
In a nondescript accent. Like, who knows what it was. Very nondescript.
Exactly, yeah. Right. All right, Sisu's in quite a few cinemas at the moment, wherever Barbie is not. So, in fact, it's not in that many cinemas at all, but do look for it around the traps.
Is it not playing in event cinemas around the place? Or
Yeah, it's doing the traps, like probably a couple of sessions a day.
Well, it's probably playing where Barbie is then. It's just in the cinema much further down the...
Next door.
...thing, yeah.
Yep. All right, let's do your big bloody grab bag of things. What are you crapping on about?
I forgot about this. Oh, look, I mean, ultimately... I just saw like a whole bunch of things that I think are worthy of talking about briefly, but certainly not enough to play or like do a proper review of it. Minx came back for season 2. This is notable mostly because it was an HBO Max original when they ended up, Warner Brothers Discovery came in and started playing around with the budgets and the line items and whatnot. They thought this show doesn't quite have the viewership for it, so off it goes. It sort of negated the fact that this made it into a lot of critics' top 10 lists for the year, mine included. First season of Minx I thought was fantastic. It's funny. It's actually got something to say. Like, it's good stuff.
If you don't know
this show, this is the one that's set in the 1970s. It's about a woman who wants to launch a feminist magazine. She's not really getting a whole lot of luck getting any publishers on board, but she ends up teaming up with a local pornographer in the San Fernando Valley. He's like a porn magazine producer. And so the two of them together start producing. Yeah. played by Jake Johnson. It's funny. They've got a very Sam and Diane from Cheers relationship about them. Second season of the show, it's kind of more of the same, but it's building on what we saw last season. It's a character drama, both the two main protagonists as well as the supporting cast as well. And we've kind of gotten to know them, and we're going to continue to get to know them as it goes forward.
Has it changed its local outlet here in Australia? Or having changed in the US?
So we found it. So in the US, it moved from HBO Max. So it got cancelled, but they kept making, they were about to finish filming the second season when it did. So they just kept production going on that and then thought they'd shop it around, which I always thought was a bit fraught because they had a lot of trouble trying to find a buyer originally with it. So there was sort of that aspect of it, but they ended up getting, I think, stars to come on board, and the show's just as naked and rambunctious as it was the first season. So nothing's really changed. Good program. In Australia, it's here on Stan. But yeah, check out that one. Futurama came back. It's been about a decade since we last saw a season of this show. This is the thing that started out. This has
me worried. Okay, is this IP regurgitation?
So here's the thing. Did four seasons on Fox back in about 1999 to 2000, thereabouts.
Yeah.
So 4 years, the early 2000s. Had a fair bit of success on DVD from about like 2006, 2007, when that rise of DVD sales really started, just bringing everything back. Based on the DVD sales, they brought it back for like four direct-to-digital DVD releases, and they were kind of terrible. Mm-hmm. Then it got picked up by Comedy Central for like another two seasons, and I wasn't really into those seasons at all. So my passion for Futurama had certainly waned over the years. Loved it at the beginning, not so keen on some of the output in the middle. But all the time, it's kind of maintained those same writers and creatives all the way through it. This current version still has the same cast. It's still got a lot of those original writers and creators on board for it. Like, the entire gang has been gotten back together. I watched the first episode. It's been brought back by Hulu. And so the first episode is very much playing into that. It's playing into the idea of what binge watching is 1,000 years from now. it's funny. Like, I had some genuine laugh out loud moments through it. But I will say that we are looking at season 8 of a sitcom that's been in our lives now for about 23 years. We kind of know what it's doing. It's kind of like watching a Simpsons episode. Like, nothing's out of the expected. Like, it is just continuing the program. So if you're just after Futurama, like, this delivers. Like, it's exactly the thing. But I did notice a few critics have maybe looked at Futurama through a different lens than what the show actually was. So I noticed a critic for IndieWire, I want to say, complaining that the show used to have all these really heartfelt moments, but especially in a sort of day and age where there's shows like The Bear around, where it shows that really lean into like those sort of more to learn, like, deeply emotional moments while also playing around in the comedy space, that why is Futurama not doing that anymore? And I'm like, well, it's only a couple of episodes into the season, and Futurama used to do that maybe once a season back in the day. So, like, what exactly are you after from this show? You kind of want it to be something that it's not. But this show is absolutely what you think it is.
Rose-colored criticism. I'm a bit guilty of it myself at times, but yeah, I get why that can be a thing.
But anyway, Futurama, like, if you want Futurama, it's back. Go for it.
All I've been reading about the Futurama reboot is that the Atman who voices Bender was in terrible pay disputes with the producers and the distributors at the channel, and he decided to come back without any pay, but now he's saying, well, these are all the things that the SAG and Writers Guild people are fighting about now. So he was kind of ahead of his time.
Yeah. Back in the day, and still really to this day, people who are just voice actors generally didn't really get paid very well. Unless you're working on The Simpsons, you just haven't been able to.
Well, they went through their own horrible moment that almost closed down The Simpsons too.
Absolutely. I mean, Simpsons is never going to get shut down, but they were actually really close to just replacing the entire voice cast of The Simpsons there one season. So they came up with a deal. But yeah, Futurama, like most other animated shows, the voice actors weren't really paid what they're worth. And particularly something like Futurama, which has made so much money in merchandise and DVD sales. And look, it's been cancelled like three times now, and it keeps on coming back because there's obviously demand for it. John DiMaggio's like, look, I just want to be paid what I think I'm probably worth in this situation. He's the fan favorite character on the program. Like, he is the heart and soul of that program. So he held out saying, look, I want to be paid more money. And they said no. And eventually it just sort of seemed as though they were never going to budge on that. They were just going to recast him and get on and going. If they had done that, I think that the fans would have definitely turned on this in a really serious way. Bender really is like just like that character. He's the thing that people are setting up for. What's that?
Katie Seagal's back.
Everyone's back.
They're all good. Okay, that's cool.
Everyone's there. Okay. But yeah, John DiMaggio, he caved. He came back. But essentially what he said is right, which is that actors are looking at the amount of money being made around the place. And they're just like, if you've got executives who are being paid, you know, $200 million each year, then why aren't we being paid a living wage?
The head of Netflix got a 31% pay increase from 2022 to 2023. Millions and millions of dollars. So it's kind of hard to put that on the table and then tell the writers and the actors, we're not going to give that any of that to you. So
there's an argument going around at the moment, which is that you look at some of that executive pay, but then you also look at the pay of some of the biggest stars in Hollywood who are also commanding large checks. And I personally don't think that anybody deserves to be making like $100 million a year. I think that's maybe a little bit high, and nobody's really quite worth that. But the argument I'd sort of say as to why star salaries aren't really even part of this conversation is that they're not the ones that are actually in charge of other people's salaries. Like, unless you're talking about like their specific production company that they own and they're hiring people themselves, like if they've been hired by a studio, by another production company, whatever, to appear in their things, they should just command whatever it is that they're able to get paid. Like, it doesn't really matter. So when I see that, Tom Cruise has made so much money off Top Gun, it's like, well, good on him. Like, that's awesome. But he's also not the person that's stopping this other person from being paid.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. Get out there on the picket line, Dan Barrett. Have you ever walked a picket line?
No, I never have.
I walked a picket line at a Gosford politician's office. They were going to tear down a whole lot of woodland and displace this giant native owl population up near Woi Woi. And Fiona and my two daughters and I got out there and picketed out the front of the local member for Woi Woi's office. So that was a thing.
I've been part of protest marches, but I've never picketed per se. I've actually never been a member of a union, to be completely honest. I'm actually very pro-union, but I guess I started out as a kid sort of where I was working retail jobs and I never really thought the retail union really protected their staff particularly very well. So it was kind of a bit of a stand of not joining that union. And then outside of that, I don't know that I've had jobs that have really been actually protected by unions.
No.
To a certain degree.
Write my own job description. And
I might have been a member of the public service union possibly. Anyway, not really sure.
And then there was all those pro-gun things that you were involved with for a while too.
Oh, yeah, but they're not really unions as much as, you know, just supporting people's rights to defend themselves, Simon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The other thing I was going to very quickly mention is there's a documentary that's available in the US, but not here yet, but I reckon we'll see it in the next couple of weeks probably. It's called Glitch, The Rise and Fall of HQ Trivia. This is a documentary that is looking back at HQ Trivia, if you remember that app from a couple of years ago.
Very much. It was our thing to do on the trip down from the coast when we lived up there. We used to play HQ Trivia. You used to sort of get your phone ready and play it, and that funny guy out the front. I watched this doco, and it was amazing to hear and very sad to hear of the how everything sort of crumbled.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I've been paying attention to the HQ Trivia story for years, and so the documentary didn't really tell me anything that I hadn't really come across. I will say the problem with this doco is that there's quite a few characters that play major roles in that HQ Trivia story that get no real airtime in this at all. Most notably, the two on-air talent that really picked up the HQ Trivia baton for the last duration of it being Mike Richards and that lady who I don't remember, but she hosted the...
They just sort of come in towards the end of the doco, don't they?
But yeah, neither of them are interviewed. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I don't really understand what was going on in terms of not giving them the proper screen time, because I can't imagine that Mike Richards or the other lady whose name I could usually rattle off, and right now it's just escaped me. But neither of them are particularly that busy, and both mention HQ in their Twitter bios. So it seems weird to me that they wouldn't be happy to talk. But anyway, it's perfectly fine. If you really want to watch a doco that for like 100 minutes, it's just playing that HQ music trivia like in the background every so often. It'll give you the thrill you're after. And I'm desperate to play HQ trivia again now. I want to see it back.
it'll bounce back in some point or some variation on it. But God, the way it collapses and the way that collapse is portrayed in the documentary is pretty spectacular. So. All right. That brings us to the end of our what was going to be a very quick but turned into an hour-long review segment. Hey. Let's move very quickly into the intermission, which I'm taking on your say-so and completely with your go-ahead, is all about me.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Simon, as one of his 35 day jobs, is running the... What's the actual name? Is the Sydney Science Fiction Festival?
Well, it has always been the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival, but as we move out across the country and we now have legs in Brisbane and a week later in Melbourne, I'm calling it the 2023 Science Fiction Film Festival / Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne.
Okay.
It sounds catchy.
So basically, if you're after a week, is it just over a weekend? Is that how we're
That's right, Thursday night through Sunday evening.
Yeah, and so what Simon's scheduling is, and what he has scheduled the last couple of years, is a range of very unusual sci-fi movies, usually sort of small indies from around the world that he has curated. Simon, when we're not doing this podcast, he'll tell me about what he's been watching during the week and the number of films he's watching through to be able to curate this properly. Like, he's putting in the work, but he really is finding a very good collection of unusual, interesting, and worth your time science fiction orientated movies, as well as a couple of older classics that he's sort of dropping in there to try to stimulate a bit of attention around the place as well. One of them this year I'm very excited by. But yeah, like, look, I've gotten, like, I don't think I've ever gotten along for a full festival because it always happens either as I'm sick with COVID or something else has just come up in my life. But I'm always very keen to get along. But I do remember, like, one of the best movies I've ever seen in my whole life was one of the films that had scheduled in there, which was this thing called Star, which is a very strange film that nobody ever want to watch at home because it's really just, it would take sequences of movies where they've just filmed, like, the stars in the background. Like, think about, like, a Star Wars movie, for example, where there's no actors on screen, but you just see some stars and maybe, like, a TIE fighter go past. And the entire film is just like collections of those scenes. And it goes chronologically from the beginning of cinema right through to modern day. And whoever the filmmaker is supposedly is going to keep on adding like a couple of scenes every year. But I don't know where it is now.
I cop so much flack for having programmed that as our opening night film because it was not an easy film to watch. As you say, it would literally cut into dialogue or as soon as the slightest bit of image came on the screen that didn't have anything to do with the star field or the universe or looking at the stars in the frame, it would cut to the next frame of stars. So there was dialogue cut into, there was music cut into. So it was often a very, very jagged watch, but it did cover 100 years of, you know, stars in cinema, not the stars we're used to, but stars in the sky. And I think it's an extraordinary film. That was the very first opening night film I ever programmed for the film festival all those years ago. This year, lot more crowd pleasing stuff from all around the world. We have films not just from the US and the UK, but we've got films from Bulgaria, we've got films from Norway, we've got films from Canada, Turkey, all these amazing feature films, a lot of which played very well at the London Sci-Fi Film Festival a couple of months ago. We've managed to pick up their audience award winner, Bystanders. We've got a film called Molly and Max in the future, which was a South by Southwest world premiere a couple of years ago. That's our opening night film across all our venues. And I know the one that you're particularly excited about. We've leant very heavily on the some of the retro titles this year. We're doing a screening of The Last Starfighter. We're closing the festival out with a 40th anniversary screening of Twilight Zone, the movie. And there in the middle, one Dan Barrett is totally over the moon with our screening of Electric Dreams off a brand new print. It's going to look beautiful. It's going to sound beautiful. You have a bit of a history with Electric Dreams, by all account. The way you reacted when I first said we were bringing it to Brisbane, it was as if you'd won the lottery.
I just never thought this was a movie I'd ever see on the big screen. Like, it's a film that I genuinely think is a very good movie. Yes. It's a film that I certainly appreciate where if I'd gone to see this film in 1984 when that movie got released, I can imagine maybe being a bit disappointed by it and think it was just a bit of trash. But I was a kid when that movie came out. My experience with it is that it was a film that my dad liked. And so when we first got a VHS player and the film came out on VHS, Electric Dreams was a purchase. It was one of the few videos we owned in the household because people never used to own videos. You just like rented them.
Rented it, yeah. And played it like seven times before you had to take it back.
No, exactly. I wonder if I've got the film sitting around here somewhere. I may have pilfered it from a cupboard at some point. If I don't have it, I'll check my parents' like cupboard and see if they've still got a copy of it. But yeah, like it was a film that, you know, it was a family favorite back in the day. And as my life's gone on, I revisit the film every so often. It just keeps getting better and better. Like it really is like a real snapshot of popcorn cinema from 1984, and it's just generally fun.
What's your preference? Apple, pear, Wang?
Oh, listen, I don't know anything about computers.
Nobody does.
Miles just bought a computer to help organize his life. He got more than he bargained for.
You're talking, you know.
Madeline just moved in upstairs. Miles is in love.
I can't play that for her. I want to squeeze you, lick you, tuck her up, and kiss you. You make her sound like a lemon.
I don't know what love is. You never told me what to feel like.
It's going to make for an interesting session because I call that session AI Then and Now. So we're screening Electric Dreams, which is about a laptop computer that becomes sentient and starts talking back and has feelings of jealousy for the next door neighbor.
He has a name, Simon. It's Edgar.
Edgar, yes, he does have a name. Pardonnez-moi. But before that, we're showing a 12-minute short film called Algo Dreams. Now, this is from a Western Australian professor called Vladimir Todorovich. He has made this film out by typing into an AI generator what an AI generator would create if, I'm trying to get this right, if it was told to create an AI-generated film. And he's created this amazing 12-minute film, had its world premiere at the Annecy Animation Film Festival a couple of weeks ago. It's having its Australian premiere with us across all three sites, Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne. It might shock a few people who are there in their, like you, who are going to be there in their pastel outfits from the 80s to watch Electric Dreams, because Algo Dreams is a whole nother thing altogether. But it's a fascinating sort of, I guess, sort of time capsule of where we are right now with what AI is doing in cinema and where we were all those years ago. On August 17, we're having an online panel called AI at the Movies, where I've got two filmmakers, including Vlad, and another filmmaker from Sydney, and a young lady coming in from London who heads up an advisory board on artificial intelligence. And she'll be, and those four will all be sort of riffing on what AI is doing to the entertainment sector and all the technical and ethical conundrums it's posing. So I'll be promoting that going forward. So there's a lot of things going on at the festival this year.
Yeah, so if people want to get along to it, what are the dates for the festival this year, Simon?
So Sydney at the Macquarie Centre Shopping Multiplex, and in Brisbane at the Brisbane City MC Event Cinema. That's from August 24 to 27 in both cities. And then a week later, we'll be in Melbourne, August 31 through to the Sunday night again, which is September 3 at Cinema Nova. All the ticketing websites are up and running now, so you can get your tickets. You can buy bulk packs of sessions as well, so bring the cost of tickets down. And like I say, there's some incredible stuff in the program there that's come our way this year. I'm actually really excited and proud of the lineup. So do get along. Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival.com.au will tell you all about it, and all our socials, of course.
But yeah, check the notes for the podcast as well. The URL will be in there. And check out the Always Be Watching newsletter on Monday, because I'll have a little bit of a wrap about it in there also.
Oh, God, you're a gentleman. I knew paying you all that money would sort of come in good later on.
Yeah, and also the Brisbane one, because Simon said MC Cinema, that's obviously the Maya Centre.
The Maya Centre, yes, for all you local people.
Although,
exciting.
I think that this weekend is the last days of trade for Maya in that Maya Centre. So I don't know what they're going to call it going forward, because there's certainly no Maya in there.
Oh, that'll be good. They didn't tell me that when I booked the site, so there'll actually be no foot traffic. I'm hoping for some foot traffic up there, but there'll be no foot traffic.
No, Simon, there's no foot traffic in that cinema.
That's why they're closing Myers.
Actually, it's a rental dispute, but anyway.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. The theory I heard, sorry, this is something of interest to people in Brisbane, and Simon tried to feign interest. The theory I heard the other day, because Maya have said that they're not leaving Brisbane, they're going to find other like real estate. I've been trying to work out where on earth would they end up taking over some space. But very soon in Brisbane, we're going to have a brand new casino open, which means that the previous casino is going to move out of the fairly, you know, gorgeous old, you know, building that it's in right now, which is just a few meters away from where the current Maya store is. So I reckon they're going to move in there. I heard that theory the other day, and I think it's spot on. Like, that's exactly where they're going to go.
Spot on. There you go. Brisbane listeners, you're welcome. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
Look, super quickly, because, boy, is this podcast spiraled out of control. I saw Oppenheimer, went for 3 hours, almost as long as this episode of the podcast. Pretty good. Things I was surprised by is how episodic it was. Yes, they kind of had some flash-forward elements in the first hour, but it felt very much that first hour, what Oppenheimer got up to before the Manhattan Project, second hour, Manhattan Project, and third hour, what happened afterwards. And it felt like every segment of that was exactly an hour long. If they were going to split that into like a three-part HBO, you know, miniseries, like they could cut that thing pretty easily. Okay. That was surprising. I was a bit surprised to see that star of the moment, Florence Pugh, that she was in it for as little as she is. Like, she's not actually in it for that much, which surprised me. But boy, is she noticeable.
So you see a lot of her. Yeah. Oh, boy, is she.
She really goes out in that film. Everyone's good. The one challenge I had with it, though, is that the entire cast is made up of character actors you've seen for years or actors who were just on the cusp of making it that never really quite did about 20 years ago, but are now like firmly in middle age and so kind of present themselves slightly different. So I spent the entire movie going, who is that guy? Who is, oh wait, it's Jason Clarke. Like, it was kind of that sort of business.
Tony Goldwyn, Matthew Modine, they're all in there, aren't they?
Oh, look, I knew Matthew Modine. Everyone knows Matthew Modine.
And we all know Matthew Modine, yeah, exactly.
No, that's all cool.
All right, so... yeah. Good, but not the ground, not the. I was going to say the earth shatterer that you might have thought it was.
I don't think it's amazing, but I do think it was very good. Like, well worth seeing the cinema. Also saw a little bit of Shin Kamen Rider, or as it's been
read.
So Shin Kamen Rider is a very well known Japanese like manga anime thing. I don't actually have that much familiarity with it, but like as far as that sort of content goes, like it's very well known and it's like right up there in terms of name recognizability. What's weird is that Prime Video have got the rights to it outside of Japan, and they've rebranded it as Shin Masked Rider, I think, which is a bit weird. But where the reason why people would want to check this film out is, a live action film is worth noting, but the director whose name I did not commit to memory, the guy that directed Shin Godzilla a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah, which was good.
He's the guy that created Neon Genesis Evangelion, which is that popular anime series. He made the Shin Godzilla movie, which is a live action film. And that was kind of like a reboot of Godzilla. But if you watch that, it kind of feels a bit like a Wes Anderson movie. Because the way that every shot is kind of framed, it's very sort of static shots, and it's supposed to be representing the bureaucracy in Japan as they're struggling to deal with a Godzilla outbreak. Anyway, very good film. There's a few clunky bits here and there, but you kind of expect that from a Godzilla film. But he's now gone and made further Shin readaptations of classic beloved things. So this is him doing Kamen Rider. And then the next one he's doing is Ultraman, which comes out in cinemas here in September, I want to say. Yep. And so Shin is, and look, I don't speak Japanese, but my understanding is that Shin is representative of like the first, like an origin. So each of these are kind of origin stories of.
Okay.
Yeah. The characters.
Good to know.
But anyway, I quite liked what I saw of it, but I put on my VR headset last night to watch this because in my VR headset, I can sit in a cinema and watch it on a really big screen. Okay. And I thought that'd be fun. And Amazon have a really good app for it. Okay. Except I fell asleep. I was really sleepy.
Just like you do in cinemas.
Well, I stayed up through Oppenheimer. Although I do think I may have drifted for like about 10 seconds in the middle of the film, but you know, we'll try to look the other way on that one. But anyway, from what I saw of Shin Kamen Rider, it seemed pretty fun. I'll definitely come back and watch more Kamen Rider.
It's the full cinema experience for you. You pay a lot of money and then you fall asleep.
Yeah, maybe. And then finally, I've been watching season 2 of The Bear all week. Man, I'm just into this show. This may be my show of the year.
Love this show. Yeah, I know. I haven't watched an episode yet. I've got to get on it because everyone just loves it.
Yeah, it's incredible. But season 2, I think, has just really stepped it up in terms of what they're doing with some of the character work. But look, I've just been watching this and every episode's like 30-ish minutes, except for one episode right in the middle. But like the 30-minute episodes, I think, are the strongest ones. And whenever I watch it, like, it makes me actually feel things, like I'm deeply invested in this program, in the characters. And I don't know, I just got thinking last night about how much talk there was around Succession and how it's going to be the Emmy Award-winning favorite in the drama category. The Bear's going to win all the comedy awards. But then I look at the two and I'm like, The Bear is just so much of a better show than Succession across the board. Like, it really is just, I think, an incredible
TV. Yeah. Succession is just a parade of horrible people doing horrible things to each other, and that's entertaining in its own way, but you don't feel for any of it.
That's exactly it. Like, I like Succession, but also it's a little bit one note, and I do think that they cancelled after 3 seasons because they knew with the 4th season people are going to recognise that show for what it is, which is it's just a bit too shallow. There's not a lot going on. Like, I really like it, but I just don't think Succession really has anywhere near the depth of something like The Bear, which is, you know, magnifique.
Magnifique. Very quickly, I watched 2 things this week that are of note. I watched a documentary series called Superpowered, the DC comic story. Now, this is very much from a sort of authorized version of the DC comic story. It's made by all the people at Warner Brothers and Max and all those places. But what I found about this was that it was quite honest in its retelling of the early days of the DC comic story and the backstabbing and corporate greed and all the things that go along with big business impacted the DC comics empire just as much as it did any other form of business. That was all skimmed over in the 100 Years of Warner Brothers series, which I tapped out of just because it was so sucky-feely and so authorized in the way it told the studio story. Corporate-y, very corporate-y. And there's elements of that in Superpowered, but, you know, when they start talking about all the different elements and how it's impacted society and how the African-American artists sort of found footage with DC and all the good things they've done, as well as a lot of the bad things they've done, I found this a fairly binge-worthy 3 episodes. I think there's only 2 episodes here in Australia at the moment, but there's this coming down the pipe very soon. Have you're a DC nut. Have you tapped into this yet?
Look, I've kept it clear of it only because it's going to be fairly corporate-y. The thing with this one is that I'm pretty certain what you were saying in terms of being fairly honest about all the backstabbing and just like horrible business relationships, those early years of what was National Periodicals and became DC. I'm pretty sure that a lot of those honest conversations probably end like in the mid to late 70s when Warner Brothers took over ownership of National Periodicals. I reckon it's probably about then that things suddenly become a bit more focused on other elements. But when it's talking about the African-American artists and writers, I'm guessing that most of that's probably about the Milestone era at DC. And if people are interested in Milestone, there's actually a dedicated documentary that wasn't made by Warner Brothers, I don't think.
Oh, really?
Like it's an independent thing. But you can find it on HBO Max, I'm pretty certain. Sorry, Max, in the US. Yeah. And however it is that you're accessing things, Simon.
Until the feds.
Yeah. If you're interested in that, like that goes much deeper into Milestone.
Well, they run through the birth of Vertigo comics and the impact that Karen Berger had on the industry at that point in time and Milestone, yes, and things like.
I bet they don't talk about recent corporate decisions to effectively shut down Vertigo and fire Karen Berger and everyone else that was affiliated with it.
They talk about the birth of Harley Quinn. They talk about the industry's reaction to 9/11. So there's all these sort of sundry and offside points in there that were really interesting. So that's what I've been watching. I also stumbled across, I'm a big fan of Mae Martin, who's a Canadian-British comic. I love Mae Martin. We fell in love with her on the we fell in love with them on the Taskmaster series when she was a contestant on that. We've gone back to a comedy series of her called Feel Good, which also stars one of our favorites, Charlotte Ritchie. Lisa Kudrow's in there, a lot of recognizable faces. We watched the first few episodes of that. It's on Netflix, and we've fallen in love with them all over again.
Yeah, this is a show on Netflix, and my memory, sorry, it's been a few years, it's a bit of an older show. My memory is that Charlotte Ritchie's a straight identified girl who ends up falling for the Mae Martin character, and then I guess has to reevaluate aspects of her life.
Exactly. Yeah. It was really lovely and very pacey at 26 minutes an episode, and just what we needed at the time. So we're hooked on that. It's called Feel Good. It's on Netflix. Yeah, two seasons. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Which brings us to the paciest part of the show, the quiz section in history. Dan Barrett, July 30, 2006. After 42 years, the longest-running music show in history comes to an end. What was the show?
This show has to be Top of the Pops, right?
Yeah. That's the answer.
Good one. Cool.
August 1st, 1971.
You got to surprise me with like a bandstand or something, but...
No, definitely Top of the Pops, the BBC's Top of the Pops. August 1, 1971, the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour debuts on CBS with which comedy legend as the first guest?
Okay, I think I've got this one, only because I was reading Wikipedia articles about some of the writers and performers that were on the show, because Steve Martin used to write on it. Bob Einstein was a performer on it. Bunch of interesting people. But I believe the first episode is... Jimmy Durante?
It is Jimmy Durante.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to get into the act. Look it up, kids. He was a classic.
I only know
And then August 3, 2001, Anne Hathaway makes her big screen debut. That surprised me. 2001. She feels like she's been around forever. In which surprise hit for Disney?
Now, I actually saw this for the first time about a month ago. This is The Princess Diaries.
Oh, Dan's got a daughter. He's watching. He's catching up on all Disney films.
It's too old for her.
You just sat down and decided to watch it?
No, my wife.
Just flicking through the Disney Plus catalog, and there it was.
My wife loaded up for some reason, and she's watching one night. I haven't seen all
of it.
I
like it.
Maybe 20, 30 minutes.
I prefer Ella Enchanted. She was so sweet and funny in that. That's a great film. But,
sure.
2001, her big screen debut. She'd only had one TV credit prior to that, according to IMDb, and then she has a hit movie for Disney. Well done, Anne. It's been a meteoric rise.
Mm.
All right, birthday time, drop in the clip. Do we still drop in the clip?
Haven't recently, but you know.
I thought not.
I've been trying to overhaul the clips, but yeah, sorry, go on.
Fair enough.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
All right, now, what do all these four have in, well, five really have in common? July 30, 1947, Arnold Schwarzenegger. July 30, 1963, Lisa Kudrow. July 30, 1974, Hilary Swank. And then you got to jump ahead to August 4, 1992, the Sprouse brothers, Cole and Dylan. What could all those possibly have in common in a kind of roundabout way this week?
Okay, so I had a theory which bore out to be pretty true. And I had to back this up by working out exactly what the relationship was between Cole and Dylan Sprouse. I knew they were brothers, but were they twins is what I had to find out. And yes, they were, because I believe that the common thread here is twins. Because Arnold Schwarzenegger, obviously his best movie is the film Twins with one Danny DeVito. Okay, Lisa Kudrow, and I think this is where you're coming from with this one. Lisa Kudrow, her character of Phoebe on Friends, as well as a character of Ursula from Mad About You, were twins.
Absolutely right, yep.
Hilary Swank... I know that like maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, at the age of, I'm going to say like 48, 49, thereabouts, ended up giving birth to two twins.
Well, I only thought it was earlier this year, like April.
Oh, maybe it was earlier this year. Maybe my timeline's wrong. But yeah, I do remember her. There was a lot of like discussion saying she gave birth at the age of like 48.
That's right.
Yeah.
Gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl, in April 2023.
Yeah, but I do remember it was twins. And then, obviously Colin Dylan Sprouse.
They played twins and are twins on The Suite Life of Zack and Cody. And then refused to sign big Disney contracts and both went off to college and now they're back doing acting again. So good for them.
Yeah.
There you go. They're all twins.
I just know one of them was in that movie, I'm going to call it Moonshot, which was one of the early HBO Max original films and one of the ones they pulled off the service. But it was okay. It was about like two people going to Mars to live or something like that and falling in love on the journey there. And then I think that same one is also in Riverdale playing Jughead Jones.
Now, by my reckoning, it's still Friday when we started recording this. So let's wrap this up before Saturday rolls around.
Okay. Spiels. My name is Dan Barrett. You can find me on Threads at the Dan Barrett. You can also find me on the social media platform X. Man.
X? What's X?
Seriously?
Oh, that's Twitter now. Oh, okay, good. Yeah. I wondered what that was. Yeah.
Start your day with my free newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. Find that one at alwaysbewatching.com. It's got the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. And obviously this Monday, there's going to be a very big science fiction film festival spiel. So watch out for that for all the details you need. And obviously on Fridays, I've got the Always Be streaming newsletter. And that's a subscriber benefit and it recounts the big shows that launched that very week.
screen-space.net or at ScreenSpace on Facebook is where you can find my original pennings. I haven't done something for a while. I better do something on that. Screen Watching is all over your socials, at Screen Watching Podcast, at Screen _ Watching on the Twitter. The Screen Watching YouTube channel is on YouTube, of course, and you can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com with all your views and opinions of this show if you've gotten this far.
Yeah, I'd prefer that people don't share their opinions, but that's just me. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week as we discuss stuff. This thing's out. Maybe I'll have watched Shin Kamen Rider and tell you all about Kamen Rider.
And you can do a review of it. I'm definitely gonna watch The Bear. I'm getting all over The Bear. And I'm
do it. It's rewarding.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Folks, we'll see you next week.